Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360. Hope you guys are doing well. I have a wonderful guest that's with me, and I'm really hyped up and pumped about this. Dr. Fred Winninger is with me. He's a veterinary neurologist out of North Carolina, and I'm really happy that you're with me. So welcome, Fred.
Awesome. Adam, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, no, thank you. I was just saying offline that, you know, those of you that probably have attended Fetch will have noticed that he has spoken quite a bit at our virtual Fetch conference. And I had to double check. I said, did you just give 8 talks at virtual Fetch? And he's like, yeah. I was like, wow, that's like, that's dedication. Thank you.
You know, the best part about this whole pandemic and the interactive lectures is I used to teach. I used to be an assistant professor at the University of Missouri. And like many of us, you know, even as students, you know, you're going through the paces of taking your notes, going through PowerPoints, and it can feel more like a job than anything else. And the reason that you're doing, the excitement kind of fades a little bit. But here, there's no continuing education credits that were coming with a lot of these lectures. There's no value in it other than the benefit of learning, you know? And so to have all of these veterinary students and recent graduates just participating for the sheer sake of wanting to be there without any grade attached to it, it's so rewarding. It's been a lot of fun working with everybody.
Yeah. So glad to have you in this profession. This is fantastic. And so you're in North Carolina. So what's going on in North Carolina?
Yeah, so I'm going to give my little quick path through veterinary world. I went to vet school in the University of Pennsylvania. I'm originally a Jersey boy. And from veterinary school, I went to University of Georgia for my internship, which was great. And then I went out to Washington State University. So I'm kind of making my path around the country for neurosurgical predominant residency, but neurology too. And then I went to University of Missouri, where I got the opportunity to work with this really great neurology program. And the focus of the neurology program outside of clinical work was translational research. The idea that we could use animal models for human diseases and for mutual benefit, that we use these animals to test treatments that will progress to humans, and then vice versa, we get the opportunity to use the money that's available to human medicine to treat our animals. So there was a couple models. Joan Coates was working on a model of degenerative myelopathy, which is still really a huge accomplishment for us as a model for Lou Gehrig's disease. But the model that I worked on mostly, you would like this, is a dachshund model of neuronal ceroid lipofuscinosis, which is a storage neurodegenerative disorder, also known as Batten's disease. And by using some advanced neurosurgical techniques, we were able to implant things like enzyme replacement therapy and gene therapy, just basically giving these animals what they were genetically lacking. The treatment was successful in helping these dogs, and it translated to humans, which was really exciting. So now humans are being treated by the research that we were performing at the university. But after a couple years in the university, the private practice bug started dinging me, and I moved over to St. Louis for 6 years, which was really rewarding. I was definitely the best neurosurgeon in St. Louis because I was the only neurosurgeon in St. Louis. And then I really wanted to try a new place. I have family in North Carolina. The practice I work at is called Charlotte Animal Referral and Emergency Care is the acronym. And it's one of the last locally owned practices in the country. And so it was really cool to get into the ground floor of a growing practice. So it's a great place. And I really like the philosophy of the practice is really for staff wellness more than anything else. So
we need that more than ever too, you know, taking care of ourselves.
So, absolutely.
Thank you for sharing that too. And for all you're doing, and good luck with everything. That's fantastic. So let's talk about something that's near and dear to both you and I, and that's intervertebral disc disease. You know, I have 4 dachshunds. You probably see a million of them too. And, to those that are listening, you know, in a nutshell, what is exactly, you know, IVDD?
Yeah, so if I were to be talking to a client that had no knowledge of this, and I first introduce myself and I say I'm a dachshund doctor and a dachshund owner, you know, there's something special about dachshunds that you have to have one to understand them. But basically, I suggest to them that dachshunds are the human equivalent of dwarfism. When we artificially bred dachshunds to have short little legs and a long back, we essentially artificially created a condition known as chondrodystrophy, which is Greek for faulty cartilage. Now, that makes them look very cute, but the consequence to that is that they develop degeneration of their discs prematurely. Whereas you or I would develop disc degeneration in our senior years, or a Labrador would get it at 8, 9, 10, dachshunds have complete degeneration of their discs by the age of 3 years old. And the disc, the anatomy of the disc, is often compared to a jelly donut. You have the gelatinous center, which is known as the nucleus pulposus, and you have the outer woven shell, which is the annulus fibrosus. And what happens is the nucleus pulposus is originally made of a bunch of glycosaminoglycans, like chondroitin sulfate, that are basically grabbing water and making it like jelly. But as these dachshunds progress in their very early years, that changed to more of a keratin-type glycosaminoglycan. And so rather than grabbing water, it repels water. And that kind of cushiony ability of the disc to work turns into more of a rigid kind of gritty sand. And that, coupled with weakening of that outer shell, can lead to some pretty violent protrusions. So what I often tell people is, you know, just like us, dogs are really good at side bends and sit-ups. But they're not really good. You got that reference there. But they're not good at the accordion on end-to-end compression. Often, like that Slinky Dog, if I often compare it to that Toy Story Slinky Dog, where the front end. That's the one. Exactly. And that front end hits the ground, and it's all this kinetic energy just translates right into the middle of the spine. So,
like, they needed another pair of legs in the middle of T12 and T13, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Or, you know, maybe some more ribs. I don't know. People often ask, why does it always happen in the middle of their back? And what we know is that cranial to that T11, 12, 13 space, the ribs have ligaments that kind of hold the spine together. So that's kind of the weakest link right there, is right caudal to it, where there's all that pressure and it's not dissipating throughout the whole spine.
And what are the differences between the type 1 and type 2 intervertebral disc disease?
Yeah, so type 1, these are arbitrary names that were created by a veterinarian known as Hansen. And essentially, type 1 is the degeneration of the inside of the disc predominantly, where it undergoes the changes that we've been talking about. Type 2, instead of a herniation which ruptures through it, type 2 is more of a slow protrusion or disc shifting that causes compression of the spinal cord. And that's the type of wear and tear that we see in non-chondrodystrophic breeds like large labs and goldens and German shepherds and things like that. So, and most dogs are probably somewhere on the spectrum of having a little bit of both. And another kind of term that's come into play is a type 3 disc, which doesn't really exist, but it's just been kind of a modern adaptation of something now that we're seeing that we have MRI. It's also known as a missile disc or a torpedo disc, where rather than a primary herniation or protrusion, a normal disc that is not that desiccated will rupture through and actually not only bang the spinal cord, but either penetrate the spinal cord or hit it and then dissipate away. Often now the new term is acute non-compressive disc herniation. So those are dogs that get spinal cord injury in the absence of needing surgery.
Wow.
Yeah.
And when they present to me as a general practitioner, for instance, they're coming in either super painful, maybe non-ambulatory. By the time they get to you, and this depends, of course, with timing, and this is what I want you to talk about, you know, sometimes it's an emergency, sometimes it's not. What categorizes something as urgent versus maybe this can wait with medical management?
Great question. So there's a couple variables in that. The first variable, like you alluded to, is the severity of it. And there's a scale from 0 to 5, 0 being normal, 1 being pain without any deficits, 2 being ambulatory but weak, paraparetic, 3 being non-ambulatory but still able to move the legs, so non-ambulatory paraparesis, 4 being paraplegia, and 5 being loss of pain perception. When you pinch the feet, the dogs don't look back and try to bite you. And I explain to clients that the reason that happens is that as you bang the spinal cord from the outside in, you affect the tracts that cause those clinical signs from step to step. So the outer tracts of the spinal cord are most important for knowing where your legs are in space. The middle tracts are more important for being able to move your legs, and the deepest tracts are important for feeling. So that's why that symptom set essentially happens in the order it does. So any dog for us that is non-ambulatory paraparetic is instantaneously a surgical candidate. It's the ones that are just painful or the ones that are weak but still able to walk that are better medical candidates. The other variable that dictates is the speed of their decline. So if we have an animal that's been hovering in one grade for a day or two, then that's considered a slow decline. But if the owners say, my dog was painful this morning, and you evaluate them and they're barely able to walk, that's a rapid decline, which probably suggests you should be doing surgical intervention. And the general algorithm is, if they're a grade 0 or 1 and you're medically managing them, we can talk about what medications, what medical or conservative management means. I lost my train of thought there. What was I saying? I was talking about, sorry, I get so excited about it, you know?
I know, I do too. I'm like obsessed just listening to you right now. Medical management.
Yeah, what I was suggesting is the algorithm is if you can medically manage them, what we do is we start them on the treatment that we can talk about in a moment, and we say, do this for 2 weeks. If at any point during that 2 weeks the dog further declines or it does not improve after 2 weeks, then they become a surgical candidate. And one of the things that's a little bit controversial is we used to never cut painful dogs, right? If they were only painful and they had no other neurologic deficit, you would never cut them. But now with modern technology, specifically MRI, enabling us to see where the disc herniation is and more advanced magnification and illumination and surgery, we're doing surgery on painful dogs very frequently that haven't responded well.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm seeing in practice too. You know, they usually take them right into surgery and do it. Just speaking really quick of your diagnostics, MRI, CT, what really is the gold standard? I know some have preferences.
Yeah, so the gold standard is not up for debate. It's always going to be an MRI. MRI is going to enable you to see not only the disc herniation and the rest of the spinal column, but it's going to let you see the degree of spinal cord compression. CT is an acceptable way, and often it is used because of its speed and because of its cost concessions, and because you can often do it in a sedated animal as opposed to an MRI, which requires general anesthesia. Some of that is changing, though, because MRIs now are starting to develop techniques where you can look at the entire spine in a 7-minute acquisition. They're called 3D T2 weighted images. And with that, we can basically take an animal from induction into the operating room in less than 20 minutes. So as the technology for MRI improves, CT is having a smaller and smaller function in treating surgical cases.
That's incredible. So you take these guys to surgery. There's a whole bunch of things that we could talk about with what you do with fenestration and all those things, but the recovery time, what are some things that you recommend post-op in terms of kind of like an integrative approach to getting these guys to walk?
Absolutely. The rapidity of their recovery is directly linked to the things that made you take them to surgery in the first place. So animals that are only painful or weakly ambulatory will likely leave the hospital the following day for us, as opposed to dogs that are more affected that will stay. General treatment, medical treatment, postoperatively is going to be pain management and managing the bladder. Recall that if animals can't move their legs, they generally don't have voluntary urination. And so we're going to have to make sure that we help them urinate, because in the absence of doing that, their bladder will become so large that it will become atonic. And even if they do develop the ability to walk, they'll be incontinent dogs, which isn't a dog that you want at home. Other kind of less medical approaches in the postoperative management are going to be things like incision management, which is going to be icing and heating. We do some passive range of motion exercises if we can. But the thing I like to do, and I think you're an advocate as well, of is get these dogs into the treadmill as soon as possible. And there is some evidence to suggest that the sooner you get them involved in that, not only is their recovery going to be more rapid, but it's going to be more complete. When I was in Missouri, we had this term, when we were asked, you know, what would be the prerequisites to sending a dog home after surgery. It would be that the dog's comfortable. It would be that the incision looks good. And then we called it can't pee, go home. So if the animals can pee, they get to go home. There's exceptions to that, obviously, of clients that you can train. But in general, that's the rule. The fourth rule that I feel most strongly about is that your clients have to be comfortable. And some clients are very comfortable with high levels of nursing care. Others are not. And I think that that's something that's often overlooked. But I think it seems obvious, but it takes a lot of good communication to make sure that your client understands your expectations about the recovery process so that you're not sending them home ill-prepared, because that will leave them with the worst taste in their mouth more than anything.
Right.
Most dogs make the majority of their recovery at week 3 and 4. The completeness of their recovery can be as long as 6 months, but generally 90% of their recovery is going to be by the 6 week mark.
Yeah. So the reason why I got kind of into this is I had a patient of mine, his name was Cosmo. He was 2 years young and he was non-ambulatory in the hind legs. And unfortunately, those of you that are listening know that this is an expensive surgery. This is an expensive disease. It's an awful one, but it's not impossible. But unfortunately, sometimes timing is important. And with Cosmo, they had a fundraiser for him to have his back surgery. But the time he presented, he had deep pain, loss of deep pain at the time of surgery. And so I said, well, let's at least try and see. But he ended up being permanently. But I will say, and I share this with those, because dogs with disabilities live an incredible life. Cosmo lived till he was 14 years young. And I'm very proud of that, because, and he inspired me to realize that dogs with disabilities are no different than the other ones. Yes, he had a cart. Yes, I had strollers. Yes, I had to squeeze his bladder. And it's a commitment, not for everybody, but there are people and organizations that really will help and step up for dogs that have these types of plegias. So I encourage you to, you know, always look at those routes, those of you that are listening, because it's not the end all be all if they say, I have no money, you know?
Right. Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the functions of surgery is to relieve pain too. And we do surgeries in dogs that are deep pain negative, if for nothing else, to make them comfortable, recognizing that they could live a disabled life. But dogs will often become comfortable. I think the rate limiters on managing a paraplegic patient in the long term are going to be, one, the bladder management, like you alluded to. Two is remembering that these dogs can't feel. They don't. Right now, as I'm sitting in this chair, I'm moving around a lot because my butt is telling me that it's going to become necrotic if I don't. The correlate to that is when they're in the wheelchair, that's fun time, but otherwise they can't stay in the wheelchair 24/7 or they're going to get bed ulcerations. And I think that's important to recognize. One of the positive things to also consider is that even if these dogs don't get normal function back, they can become the so-called spinal walker, where they don't necessarily feel their feet, but the reflexive movement that's inherent to the spinal cord actually returns. They get this kind of herky jerky walk, but it's a functional walk. So there's a lot of potential for positive outcome, even what would be considered a negative outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've seen it on both ends too, as a veterinarian, as also as a dog dad. And I was just telling you before, two of my babies had hemilaminectomies and they walked after the surgery. So, but I do feel that timing is important. My general rule as a practitioner is, and this is a general rule, but I say, if they wag, they walk, you know, if they can, if they can wag their tail and they're still non-ambulatory though, I feel very positive of the outcome that I think that they'll be able to ambulate after surgery.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What are your thoughts? This is a big thing too, I guess. I'm hearing about the PDLAs, the percutaneous disc laser ablations. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm very impressed by it. So basically that procedure was created by Ken Bartels at Oklahoma State. Danielle Dugat kind of took the torch of that over. There's a couple practices that offered it. When I was in St. Louis, I offered it as well. Basically, it takes the percentage likelihood or the prevalence down in dachshunds to get intervertebral disc disease from 12% to somewhere between 2 and 4%. It's a very safe procedure. The morbidity associated with is low. Some of the bad things that can happen are discospondylitis or spinal cord injury from it, but it's very, very rare. So I think it's a great procedure. I think it's technically challenging to some. The lasers aren't readily available. And you never know if your dachshund's going to be the one that has the disc herniation. So people aren't inclined to perform a $2,000 to $4,000 prophylactic procedure for something that may never happen.
I agree with you. It's a tough discussion to have. It really is, you know, but, you know, one of my guys who's howling right now, Connor, he was on the schedule to have one done. And lo and behold, two weeks up to the point, he blew out a disc. So I was like, you know.
You're kidding.
So I was like, what are the chances? I was like, oh my gosh. So,
you know, the thing about that procedure that I think a lot of people don't recognize is it really only works well in young dogs. The principle of the laser is that it has a lot of different effects, what are called photothermal, photoacoustic, but it relies on the presence of water. So if the discs have become so degenerate that there's no water in them, it won't work. And I think that's another hard part for people to wrap their heads around. They want to do it at the age of 8, 9, 10 after the dogs have one disc herniation, but it has to happen in younger animals.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Dr. Winterjar, I could talk to you forever about this because this is such a hot topic and it's so near and dear to both you and I. But this was fantastic and thank you so much. Where can we, again, find some more information about you?
Absolutely. Thanks for that. So on Instagram, I post a lot of stories of our patients and try to provide some little education tidbits for our veterinary colleagues. So my Instagram is animalneurodoc. Some other places that you can find me, obviously, is on the CARE website. And then I also have a 3D veterinary printing company. We print out custom surgical tools and anatomy for individual patients that enables us to perform really advanced surgeries, not only for neurosurgery, but also orthopedics. And so we have a Facebook page and an Instagram page. It's all 3D veterinary printing. It might be of interest to a lot of our listeners today.
Yeah, that's super cool. You know what? I think I'm going to take you up on that offer. We're going to have to chat about that as on our next podcast is 3D printing. That's cool. Yeah.
Awesome.
Those of you that are listening, you need to follow Fred on Instagram. His stories are fantastic. They're completely educational. And he's just an overall incredible human being. And we're so proud and honored to have him in this profession. So at Animal Neuro Doc, you need to follow this guy because he is moving things and saving lives and making animals walk. So shout out to Dr. Fred.
Thanks, Adam. I really appreciate that. Thanks so much.
No, thank you for being on the show. And everybody, thank you so much for tuning in. Hope you're staying safe out there. Take care of your fur babies and stay pawsome, everybody. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay pawsome.